open. I'd like to start with an announcement, which is that our committee chair will be back on Wednesday. Representative Bruce Starr will be back, and we will meet on the 24th as scheduled. Today we have invited testimony, and our first testimony is from the Oregon Public Courts Association. I'd like to ask Mr. Ken Armstrong and Mr. Keith Levitt to come and present their testimony.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, could you tell us who the banner is, because I don't have an agenda that we can provide that.
Oregon Public Courts Association. And we're going to try to keep on a schedule of about 15 minutes per group, if that works. If you have much more than that, let me know, and we may try to speed it up a little.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll do our best to keep tight to the schedule. I know you've got a lot of people that want to speak after us, and not a lot of time to do it, so we will be brief. I'm Ken Armstrong. I represent the Oregon Public Courts Association and also the Oregon Courts Group. Those are two separate groups that have some overlap of the same courts. The Oregon Ports Group are primarily the issues-driven ports, including Portland, St. Helens, Coos Bay, and others. It's the Oregon Ports Group that is going to be most active here in the building. The Oregon Public Ports Association is really more of a not an issue-driven association, but just generally interested in promulgating the interests of the ports around the state. I want to give you a real quick overview of ports in Oregon, some of the things that we do, and have it be extremely brief so I can give the bulk of the time to Mr. Levitt from the Port of Portland, who has some more substantive things to discuss with you, some of the projects that are out there. There are 23 ports in the state of Oregon, obviously ranging down from Brookings Harbor on the southern Oregon coast, stretching northward to Astoria at the mouth of the river, and then upriver to Portland, and then extending into the mid-Columbia River. The easternmost ports are Morrow and Umatilla. As I said, there's 23 ports. They are all local government special district organizations, structured under Oregon Revised Statutes Chapter 198. And then we also have some very specific powers and duties that are enumerated in ORS 777. I'm not going to go into a great level of detail on that, but they really focus on a couple of areas, and that's transportation and economic development. Let me give you a real quick snapshot of generally the three categories, as I like to divide them, of ports in the state. This is not statutory. This is just a general categorization. Tourism / fishing / economic development ports are the first ones that you see down there on the list. They are our smaller ports and range up to those that are somewhat larger, including Alsea, Bandon, Brookings, etc. The next category would be our mid-Columbia shallow draft ports, and those are primarily those in the gorge and east of the gorge, Umatilla, Morrow, Arlington, the Dalles, Hood River, and Cascade Locks. A lot of those ports have a direct relationship with the Port of Portland, as they are part of the shallow draft barging system that filters material, products, et cetera, down to Portland. And then finally, we have the deep water ports in Oregon. Those are Astoria, Coos Bay, Newport, Portland, and St. Helens. As I mentioned earlier, there's really two significant areas for ports in Oregon. That's as an economic development generator, and then a transportation link. There are lots of different categories. All these ports do many different functions, but generally they focus on those two areas. Economic development functions include manufacturing parks, commercial retail developments, marinas and boat launches, etc. And on the transportation side, it's really focused on the marine, the rail, and the aviation side. Ports own and operate railroads and airports. They own docks, wharves, etc. There's just all the facilities that go into economic development and transportation you will find are done by ports. They're a very unique animal. And I'd be more than happy and will intend to provide more information to you on the details of what they do and how they do it. The two biggest challenges that face ports these days, I think if you talk to any individual port, you're going to find different priorities for each one of them. But broadly speaking, I think it really focuses in two areas. And one is balancing environmental issues and concerns with the need to promote economic development and growth and create jobs in their areas. And then secondly, frankly, it's funding for roads and highways. on the coast, getting people to and from, visitors to and from the coast, on those coastal highways, and of course on 101 is a major issue, and then the major highway corridors of 84 and I-5 are significant for the movement of product. With that, and I realize that's brief, I want to turn it over to Keith to talk a little bit more specifically about his port and some of the activities they're involved with.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Keith Levitt with the Port of Portland, and I've provided a couple of handouts for you, and I'll allude to those. One is a brochure of our marine facilities at the Port of Portland, and the other is a study that I'll just briefly describe in my comments. The Port of Portland has a mission to provide competitive transportation access for both people and freight in this state and the region. And that that access is really access to the international marketplace. And it's the manifestation of that mission is really out of our two main areas of business, and that is aviation and marine cargo transportation. We are a transportation agency. The port is kind of a hybrid. Our funding really comes from the private sector. About 1% or so is from the property tax base of the Tri-County area in the metropolitan region. And yet all of our authority comes from you, from the state statute, and our commission is appointed by the governor. So we're a hybrid between state, local government, and the private sector, and which makes our job challenging. We own and operate four airports, PDX plus three general aviation airports at Hillsboro, Tolino, and Molino and Troutdale. I'll just quickly describe probably the number one as far as transportation issue for consideration out at PDX is the growth in air freight. That's been the number one growth area for us. And that has gone hand in hand with the high tech industry that has come into our economy and helped diversify our economy. E-commerce, just-in-time delivery, all of those phrases that you might hear in transportation policy discussions are all alive and well in this increase in air freight that we're seeing. And that's going to be that's a real growth area, and that's one that I'd be glad to talk more with the committee about. I mentioned this to the chair last week when I met with him, and we may try to put together a panel discussion on those types of issues, what's happening in e-commerce and what's happening with high tech and air freight. With regard to the marine side of our business, we own and operate five marine terminals along the Willamette and the Columbia River, five different business lines. One is containers, and I'm going to talk a little more about that in a moment. Two is the shipment of grain. We also ship bulk, mineral bulk exports out of one of our terminals, break bulk products, and autos. And the Port of Portland is in the marine side is really just a part of an overall Columbia Snake River system, a very unique system that extends 465 miles inland all the way to Lewiston, Idaho. The deep draft part of the system goes from Astoria to Portland, and that's about 105 miles up the river, maintained at a 40-foot navigation depth. And we have a very simple little project that we're trying to do called the Channel Deepening Project to move it to 43. Just three more feet is what we're asking for. That project's been in the works for about 11 years, and there's a proposal in front of you this session to help fund to provide the state share of that project. I'm glad to answer any questions you might have on channel deepening. But one point I do want to make is that the 40-foot channel is maintained annually, has been maintained for years. Dredging occurs annually to maintain it at that 40-foot depth. Upriver from Portland, though, is a very unique barge system. We, of course, have a very export-rich economy. In the eastern part of Oregon and Washington and in Idaho, we have an agriculture sector there that is producing not only the crops but also adding value and manufacturing food products that are now going out in containers. And this is the premier container on barge system in the United States. It used to be that you didn't put containers on barges. Only bulk products went on barges, but that's changed, and we've been a real leader in that. And that adds a lot of value that keeps jobs in our rural counties. Those products, of course, then go down the river to Portland and out to international markets. I think I'll just mention, as far as our standing in the world as a player in the world, really it's on the agriculture side. We're number one in the country as an export port for wheat. We're number two in the world. If you take all the lower Columbia River ports together, it's number two in the world, just behind the Mississippi as a grain export center. Fourth in the country as an auto handling center, and a major player on the West Coast as far as import and export of autos. Real quickly on containers, we are not a big player on movement of containers out of the Columbia River. If you look at the West Coast ports, whether it's LA Long Beach or Seattle Tacoma, but what we do try to serve is the regional exporters. So again, we have, and the reason I put this study in front of you was to demonstrate, if no other point than this one, that the Terminal 6, which is the container facility at the Port of Portland, on page 23 of this study, you're going to see a breakdown of benefits derived by having container access on the lower Columbia River. This study assumed that you would lose, what happens if we didn't have that container access, how much more costs would be borne by those companies throughout Oregon to get their containers to another port to ship. And that total number is $68 million annually. And the benefits of containerization are in 28 out of 36 counties in Oregon. This is not a Portland issue. This is a statewide issue. The top four counties benefiting from containerization are Multnomah, Marion, Lane, and Umatilla. And then you go to the next tier, it's Jackson, Washington, Central Oregon, Morrow County. So it starts to move all over the state. And the point here is the importance of having competitive transportation access for containers on the river. Containers are the number one, if there's one sector of cargo shipping that does need the deeper draft, needs the 43-foot channel, it's containers. And with that, I'm just going to I'll stop and just mention a couple of key issues that we're looking at for the future. One I mentioned is channel deepening. Another one is Asian service for air. You may know we lost Delta, which provided direct service from Portland to Asia, and we're trying to market our region to another air carrier to come in and provide that service. The third big issue that we're worried about is how to service demand. Trade in our area is supposed to triple in the next 20 to 30 years. And the land, the availability of land to be able to move those products, let alone a transportation system that currently is not equipped to do that, is a real key issue. And finally, we've been focused a lot on what's happening upriver with the dam breaching issue and fish recovery. So with that, I'll stop, and I realize that was a shotgun kind of blast of issues, and we'd be glad to answer any questions or come back at another time for more substantive discussions.
Thank you, Mr. Armstrong. Mr. Levitt, do we have any questions from the panel? Yes, Representative Brown.
Keith, is there any loss of shipping opportunities now because of the lack of channel depth in the navigation channel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, I don't know that we've lost any direct carrier service yet. Hanjin left about 3 or 4 years ago, citing channel depth, and they have since then come back. But we know from the carriers that this is a significant issue, and what the issue is that a lot of the container carriers, they are bringing online their new ships that do require the deeper draft, and they have a rotation along the West Coast that they move those ships, and if they can't service that rotation with the larger ship that they want to have call, let's say LA, and also come up to Portland on their way back to Asia, then they're not going to call Portland, and so that's going to be the issue as these larger ships come online.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Armstrong, I truly hope that you'll include our Highway 99W in Yamhill County as one of those, make it your third, concern for moving product, because it's greatly impacting our Yamhill County, that bypass that's needed in our county, and it's really critical to the economic development of that whole area.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, you raise a good point. It gives me a good opportunity to expand just a little bit. You're absolutely right. There are lots of highway corridors that have a significant role in the movement of freight, goods, people around the state of Oregon. One of the things that you may not be aware of, and you should know, is that there is currently a Freight Advisory Committee within ODOT. That is a body that was established a couple of years back as a consultating body to the director. And it's entirely probable that you will see legislation from us that would codify that in statute this session. We are very interested in the work of that committee. It's done a good job of beginning to raise a lot of the issues about where is freight flowing, what are the trends in the commodity movements, what are the critical corridors, including 99W, that are involved in moving that freight, and how is the state of Oregon responding to making those investments, and are we making investments in the right areas from a purely freight mobility driven standpoint. So your point is well taken, and I think that is something that we would really like to have be part of that look-see. So thank you for raising that point.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Would there be a report yet on the impact of the non-improvement of some of these corridors to freight movement? Do you have any statistics that are now available?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the document that we probably ought to make sure we get in your hands, and the entire committee ought to have a copy of this if you don't already, is a study that was done under the leadership, but done within the staff capacity of the Department of Transportation, which is called Freight Moves the Oregon Economy.
Ooh.
And that is a document that takes a preliminary cut at where are the key corridors, where are the obstacles to freight movements, what are some of the next steps that need to take place from having our system be on top of where the trends are going and to stay a leader in national and international trade. That raises some of the issues. It doesn't necessarily resolve all of them. But that would be the only report that's really come out to date. I could certainly come up with a to-do list for that Freight Advisory Committee that would produce some of the exact stuff that you're interested in. And we're in the process of evaluating where we go here over the next year. I happen to be the chair of the Freight Advisory Committee for this current year, and we're trying to get some pretty aggressive plans on the road to make those things happen.
Mr. Chair, may I have one more question?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Leavitt, having been in the air freight business for most of my past 26 years, and I worked on a concept with Governor Goldschmidt to develop an intermodal hub at the Port of Portland, and having been a part of an aviation enterprise that became the largest private cargo carrier in the world, we felt that we had moved in the right direction, as Governor Goldsmith joined us in working in Taiwan with Evergreen Shipping Lines, which is no part of Evergreen International Aviation or Airlines in McMinnville. What I'm concerned about is have we expanded the concept of intermodal transportation at the Port of Portland, combining all the means of rail, water, air, and truck? And if not, what do we need to do to build that market? I think we're in a very viable position to boost this low job growth rate state to something that will substantially raise the wages and assist in eliminating, the poor working class individuals in our community who need a substantial increase in wages.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I do believe the concept of intermodal is evolving and expanding, and as I mentioned, I believe as we look at trends, particularly for high tech and the use of all people and businesses in e-commerce, that trends in warehousing and logistics and of moving products along all the modes, and where you locate your warehousing and distribution facilities, which we have been doing that out at the airport, along Airport Way, of trying to get some consolidated warehousing, so that you're not using the entire transfer. You're not in Yamhill County trying to send something up through PDX, and so that is an evolving concept, and I believe we're tracking with the question that you had. I'd be glad to get you in touch with some of our folks who are much more knowledgeable than I am on it, but those trends are ones that we are keeping an eye on and that we're definitely trying to plan for.
And my last follow-up, Mr. Chair, I promise.
Please. I'm going to remind the committee that we have 7 presentations and we want to get through everyone this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is our position as far as inventory, warehousing? I heard you ask for land. I didn't specifically hear you talk about that, the warehousing need.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, what I was alluding to is the trend towards, away from inventories sitting in warehouses for weeks before they're called out, and much more towards just-in-time delivery, meaning that companies are now taking orders, producing the product, and getting it out onto the transportation system. So you're seeing a shift from a reliance upon inventories in warehouses and more of a reliance upon an efficient transportation system. And that's the trend that we're seeing, and it has implications for where you make your investments for freight mobility and for warehousing in the future. And that's the point I was trying to make.
Thank you very much for your testimony. It's clear to me with your background in transportation, this will be an ongoing dialogue.
Yes.
Thank you. I'd like to now invite Marshall Koba and Gary Katzian of the Consulting Engineers Council of Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Marshall Koba, representing the Consulting Engineers Council of Oregon. With me today is Gary Katzian from Kittleson & Associates in Portland, and Gary is the chair of our legislative committee, and he's going to make a few comments on the engineer's perspective on transportation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and representatives. I'm a representative of Consulting Engineers Council of Oregon Board of Directors, and I'm also the chair of the legislative committee. A little background on the Consulting Engineers Council of Oregon. We're a nonprofit organization that has over 125 member firms in the state of Oregon. We represent over 3,000 employees. Our firm is also a member organization of a larger national organization, the American Consulting Engineers Council, and that organization has over 5,700 member firms around the country. Our board and its member firms have supported, and we will continue to support, the efforts made by the Oregon Legislature to provide sufficient funding for transportation facilities within the state. An increase in the current funding levels is very important to our members for the following reasons. We'd like to see a continued high standard of livability for our employees and our families. We'd like to see a continued economic viability for our private clients. We'd like to see we receive direct revenues that result from services that we provide to our public clients, ODOT, cities, counties, service districts, ports. And we also receive direct revenues that result from new private development that is conditioned with additional transportation facilities that need to be designed to support those private developments. Maintaining a high standard of livability is one of the goals that Oregon's highly recognized land use planning goals provides to its citizens. The Oregon Administrative Rules, specifically the Transportation Planning Rule, Goal 12, that it's implementing rules, requires that there's a balanced approach between land use types and intensities within the state, the transportation facilities funding, the transportation modal choices that people have, and then also how well the transportation system works. That balance is very delicate. If any of those four factors are out of balance, the whole system begins to waver. From my experience in transportation, because our firm is strictly a transportation planning and engineering firm in Oregon, but we do work all across the country, the Oregon model is one that's being held very high because it does do that very delicate balancing act. However, I think over the past 10 years, it's becoming to be very close to be dangerously out of balance, and one of those four factors that's closest to being totally out of balance is the funding measures that, or funding levels that we have. Since the last economic depression of the early 80s, we've experienced almost two decades of growth in population as well as outstanding business opportunities in the state. A lot of our employees do not remember what an economic downturn even looks like. We've gone almost a full generation without any kind of impact of a slowdown. During this time, businesses and people from around the nation and world have found Oregon to be a very desirable place to grow and live. It's been primarily due to the attractiveness of our natural and man-made resources. We've had a strong commitment to funding public facilities and services, plus a desire to balance that with the preservation of our natural resources. However, the growth in population and employment opportunities produce an increase in demand on our state's transportation facilities. In fact, there's been a tremendous decrease in funding levels per capita over those past 10 years. Population and employment opportunities in our designated urban areas are expected to almost double over the next 20 years. Without increasing the transportation funding levels, the congestion levels will reach intolerable levels. An indication of what's to come, we've seen a number of jurisdictions, including ODOT over the past year, lower their standards by which they measure the transportation performance of our system. Those higher levels of congestion have actually made congestion acceptable, and those higher levels of congestion will become sort of the norm, and that will impact our citizens and our businesses' perception of livability within the state. One of the messages that's been brought about by some of our leaders has been that we can't build our way out of congestion. Our membership would challenge you with that. We do not believe that you cannot afford to not build your way out of congestion. Doesn't mean that it all has to be highways, but you still have to invest in the transportation system to make sure it's working properly and acceptably to our citizens. If additional funding cannot be found, we are going to be required to reevaluate those land use decisions that we have made over the past few years. For example, there's been a number of land use decisions that have allowed increased density, increased population to respond to the marketplace. However, improvements along the I-5 corridor, Highway 26, 217, Highway 18, 99, you can just continue to go down the list, have not kept up with that. So we're seeing increased congestion on those facilities, and nothing right now is online to remedy that. We're seeing that. We're studying them over and over again, and I think Representative Nelson brought up a good point. I'm on the consultant group that is working on the Highway 99 corridor, but it's been 15 years since people basically came out and said, we're congested. 15 years, we haven't seen any improvements out there. Within our industry, the reduction of transportation funding has also caused some of our member firms to reduce staff levels. Discussions I've had with a number of our members have indicated that somewhere between 30% and 40% reduction in ODOT-related design and construction contracts have occurred over the past 10 years. However, it's also this reduction in funding has made our firms actually stronger because we've had to search out other places to find clients. Our firm, particularly about 10 years ago, was 20 people. We're now up to 55 people in Portland. But we've also had to expand our wings. We've had to go to other states. We're doing quite a bit of work in Alaska, Washington, California. In fact, in the last 2 years, we've actually opened up two offices in Florida and one in Baltimore. A lot of that is in response to trying to find public work. Our Florida office while it only has five people, we're actually doing more State Department of Transportation work in Florida than we are here in Oregon, where we have 55 people. One other fact out of Florida that we're finding, and while there's a lot more competition there, State of Florida actually spends more on consultants as extension of their own public staff than the state of Oregon spends on capital budget and improvements. A strong economy brings revenues and human resources into the state. A strong transportation system helps to fuel that strong economy. Increasing the transportation funding levels is a commitment and investment to our state's future. Our member firms are ready, we're able, and we're to support your efforts in making this strong commitment to our citizens. We have the technical and managerial capabilities to provide the state and local agencies excellence in planning, design, and construction services. The use of consultants can be done as an extension of the public staff, so you're not having to see, so you wouldn't have to increase the labor forces of the government itself. So it doesn't necessarily mean that as we increase funding that you have to have a larger government to support that. Our members have a proven track record of providing these services both within Oregon and also throughout the West Coast. A lot of our firms, while a few of them are very large offices of national and international type firms, the majority of our 125 members, though, are small firms. We're small businesses that have decided to locate in Oregon, and we want to stay in Oregon. Our members have received national recognition for projects like the landslide remediation along Highway 101, transportation management and rehabilitation of the I-5 bridge over the Columbia River. We've worked with transportation system improvements, improving signalization. So we've got a lot of experience to provide the state and our citizens. If new transportation funding is provided, though, our citizens will demand timeliness and certainty of providing specific improvements. We will need to identify those specific projects and a clear expectation of when they'll be on the ground. One of the things that I think has frustrated citizens over the years is that it's been typically a 7 to 10 year process from concept to actually being able to drive or ride on a new transportation facility. In our digital world, that's not acceptable anymore. We have to find ways to communicate better, to work with the agencies that are involved, to provide solutions before those problems become non-problems. After 10 years, the whole problem set has changed. We're getting ready to spend millions of dollars on improvements that were yesterday's problems, not today's problems. So I think the process has to move quite a bit faster. Our members are also ready to help educate the general public in the benefits of the support. With that, I'd like to leave you some time for questions. I thank you for this opportunity and look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Senator Devlin.
Thank you. The need for transportation improvements is probably, you know, extremely pronounced and probably recognized by most people that are in elected positions, whether at the city, county, or state level. But there's been a reluctance of the legislature to approve new transportation dollars, and there's certainly been a reluctance by the public to approve new transportation dollars. I don't know if my figures are, it's been a while since I've looked at the numbers, but I kind of remember for the Portland metropolitan area some figures that came out a few years ago. It was to keep the Portland metropolitan area close to service level D in modernization over the next 20 years, it would cost about $11 billion. And that we currently had over that period of time about $1 billion available. And Metro has projected that they could keep us from going much below level service E for about $3 billion. Now, that's about, you know, $2 billion more just to keep us at service level E,
right?
Which is about the equivalent of $100 million a year, which is about the equivalent that all 4 cents of a gas tax would generate for the entire state. And when you consider only 50, you know, only about 40% of that would probably go to the metropolitan area, we would be talking about a 10-cent gas tax just to keep us at service level E. What would you suggest?
The answer was that I probably wouldn't be sitting in this seat. I'm also a member of TPAC, the Transportation Policy Advisory Committee, as a citizen member up in Metro, and so I am getting involved in that part of it. And the concern that we have, and the concern I've heard through a number of hearings, is that Metro has not accepted level service E. If level of service E was acceptable, that's a little bit under capacity of your system. What has been promoted is actually a level service F for 1 hour and E the second hour. And so it's basically extending the...
Can you describe what level service F is? So that
failing. basically, your demand is more than what your capacity of your system is. It's just like in school. An F is not good. You don't come home with an F. And so it's been a reaction that they've had to go to that level of service to substantiate the increase in population and employment that everybody would like to see to keep the economy going. And the question is, how long is the citizens going to tolerate that? They're beginning to see some effects of that. If you've been on Highway 26 during the rush hour, it's actually more traffic going out towards Hillsboro than there is going into Portland. And part of that reason is they've increased the employment opportunities in the Sunset Corridor are now higher. There's more employment in the Sunset Corridor than there is in downtown Portland. But the transportation facilities hasn't changed since I moved here in 1979. It's still a four-lane highway. And MAX doesn't serve the majority of that corridor. It serves part of that corridor, but not all of it. And so, again, there is no easy answer, but there is going to have to be, at some point in time, a commitment. And whether that's done strictly with gas tax or there's going to have to be localized taxes, and I'm not sure what the absolute answer is, but it is something that will have to be brought to the attention of the public. The public in Oregon has been good over the last 20 years of funding improvements in transportation, both MAX lines. Washington County has a tremendous success with their major streets transportation improvement projects. I think it's when projects are defined for them, and they're given a clear indication of when they can see those improvements, that they've responded with money. And what's happened to date is that a gas tax used for the statewide purpose, there hasn't been attachments of projects. And so they're not sure when they're going to get it. It may be 15 years. It may be 20 years. Maybe it's hopefully sometime in our lifetime that they may see improvements in Dundee and Newburgh. But there's no certainty to it. So you're not sure if you get a gas tax, are you actually going to see products? And that's, I think, the piece. The last legislative measures you came out with last session, I think, went a long way to proving to the public that you could do it. I think part of the problem, though, there was not a clear indication from the public side of how they were going to get there, and also the whole issue of the weight mile tax for trucks. There was a number of reasons, but I think the dialogue has started, and that's where I think you've got to keep moving with the dialogue.
Thank you very much, Mr. Katzin.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can you ask for written testimony? We have nothing.
Yes. You have written testimony handout.
I can make that available.
We should. Yeah. To the administrator would be terrific.
Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to invite Gene Wilkinson and Don Schellenberg from the Oregon Farm Bureau.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, Associate Director of Government Affairs of the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'm here today because I'm the senior staff person with the Oregon Farm Bureau. And with me today is Gene Wilkinson. Gene is on our staff, joined us just about 2 years ago. And Gene has, I've been handling the transportation issues in the past. Gene is going to be handling them in the future. Be happy to work with her and with you if that's necessary, but she's going to be the major person that deals with transportation issues this session. So I'll turn the mic over to her.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Again, my name is Jean Underhill Wilkinson. I've been with the Farm Bureau for a relatively short time. I think it's a little closer to 1 year than two. It seems like I've been around forever, but... So I am still learning the Farm Bureau process, and transportation issues are a little bit new to me, but I'll enjoy learning about them more and working with you during the session. Even though I've only been with the Farm Bureau about a year, I do have an extensive background in agriculture issues. I've had various agriculture jobs through my life, and my family are homesteaders just south of the Dalles in the area surrounding the town of Duffer. And fortunately, my parents are still farming that property today. They farm dryland wheat, and I'm a part owner of that farm and still help to make the management decisions. So I have some vested interest in some of these issues. And of course, the farming community in Oregon has an interest in maintaining the ability to transport farm products from farm to market for a reasonable cost. So Farm Bureau will be involved in some of these transportation issues, but not all of them. Some of these issues, such as self-service gas, gasoline, and photo red lights, we may not be taking positions on, but we do have a few issues that we'll be working pretty hard on. With the Farm Bureau, we do have committees made up of actual farmers, grassroots folks that come to Salem to discuss some of these issues in the areas that Farm Bureau tries to deal with, one of them being transportation. Farm Bureau has made up a transportation committee that I'm already in communication with extensively and will be throughout the session. I've started to go over the bills. There's about 20 bills already that have been introduced, and I've begun to communicate with our committee on those bills. So any ideas that we bring to you come from the farmers themselves, requests that they have to make their transportation a little bit easier. I'll just mention a couple that we'll be working on. One issue is House Bill 2561. It's regarding sifting loads. Our farmers in the past have had the ability under Oregon law to acquire sifting, what are called sifting and leaking load permits. Unfortunately, the statute is limited and narrow to only include fluid leakage that may come from farm trucks as those farm commodities are hauled from the farm to market. There's also a need out there for a permit or the availability of some allowance of fluids that may come out of trucks as those trucks are going down the road. This would allow the local authority to issue permits to farmers for not only fluids, which is currently allowed, but also solids such as hay or silage that may be hauled down the road. That local authority would also have the ability to revoke those permits if it's going to play havoc with public safety and other vehicles on the road. So that is one bill that we will be working on. Another bill is House Bill 2562. It has to do with driver's license restrictions. As some of you may recall, last legislative session, there was a law put into place that restricts drivers within their first year of acquiring their license. They can't have, for the first 6 months, they can't have any person younger than the age of 20 in the vehicle with them as a passenger. For the second 6 months after acquiring the license, you can't have more than three passengers, I think, under the age of 20. Well, when it comes to farming and harvest seasons, when labor is intense and timelines are real tight, there's a lot of farmers that have a lot of people employed during those times and have a lot of young people employed. And when you're trying to move from field to field to get that crop put in those trucks, and the young people cannot ride with one another in the vehicles to transport themselves from job to job, that becomes a problem. And that is something our farmers have recognized that may come up. So this would allow for folks that are employed for farming purposes, they would be relieved of that restriction. Another and the final issue is with regard to ATVs. That is a bill that will come from the Senate side. Majority Leader Dave Nelson has received multiple requests from his constituents on this, and that is when agriculture changes and it becomes more labor-intensive because of environmental issues and other issues. For example, in the ranching industry, they need to herd cattle around a lot more intensely to keep those cattle moving and keep them off the creeks and those types of things. When it comes to applying chemicals, our farmers need to maybe spot spray a lot more to be very, very careful on where that chemical is being applied. And ATVs come in real handy for those purposes to get around quickly, especially on rough ground when you can't get your vehicles to some of these remote areas. And ATVs, when it comes to switching from field to field and you need to drive down the road, you're not legally allowed to do that. So you have to put your ATV into the back of your pickup just to go across the road to another field. So the farming community, the agriculture community, would like to be relieved of the restriction of not legally being able to use your ATV on a highway. And that, so that bill will come before you too, but it will be coming from the Senate side. So in summary, there's a few more issues that we'll be working on and that we'll be watching very closely that will be before you. So again, I will enjoy working with you and talking with you more closely about these bills. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Ms. Wilkinson, just a quick question about, I think, the second to the last proposal. You're seeking an exemption then from the provisional driver's license for new drivers that would allow more than one to drive together. So your member organizations are employing a lot of people that are, say, age 16 that are new drivers and
yes,
driving farm equipment or pickup trucks, or what is it that you're specifically wanting them to be able to?
Representative Rosenbaum, yes, during harvest seasons on the farms, large numbers of young people within those local communities are employed to drive trucks, to drive sometimes farming equipment, to drive pickup trucks. And they need to be able to transport themselves from field to field. As one field is harvested, you know, they need to move quickly to the other field and move all the implements, all the machinery. And so it's like a circus train going down the road. And in order to conveniently do that, some of these young drivers need to be able to transport other young workers with them. And the agriculture community feels like this restriction would impair their ability to quickly and efficiently move from field to field during harvest seasons.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, in addition to that, the irrigation issue. This is where the issue first came to light after the bill was passed. A lot of young people do the irrigation. They're moving hand lines. They're going from field to field. They work in teams. And legally, they couldn't both be in the same pickup and go to the field at the same time.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I invite Mr. Buck Taylor and Mr. Jim Belay to come representing the Oregon Pilots Association.
We're having a hard time, Mr. Chair, understanding the names because we have no written copy or organization.
Okay. I've been asked to repeat your name so that everyone can hear them clearly. It's Mr. Buck Taylor. And perhaps I'm mispronouncing your last name, Mr. Jim Belay.
Jim Belay.
Jim Belay.
Belay.
Yeah. Belay. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, representatives, I wanted to thank you for inviting me to testify today. I represent the Oregon Pilots Association, which is a volunteer organization of about 1,700 to 1,800 pilots. We mainly transport ourselves and our families around the state of Oregon and are mainly users of, the small airports in the state of Oregon and the rest of the United States. We are probably 80-90% of the users that use the small airports in the state. So we're very concerned about what happens with the Department of Aviation and what goes on at these small airports. We are very happy that the Department of Aviation has been separated from transportation. We believe that it is a definite step in the right direction for the pilots of the state of Oregon to get better representation and be able to get in touch with the staff in Salem. One thing that we are concerned about is money that is appropriated to improve those airports. A lot of the airports in the state, as you know, have been in a state of disrepair for a few years. That's getting better and better all the time. With the movement out of the Department of Transportation, that right off the top there was $40,000-$50,000 that they did not have to pay for overhead to the Department of Transportation. We hope that that will help improve some of the airports that need it. Another thing that the pilots like is a direct link to the staff, and knowing that when you have a direct link to the staff at the Department of Aviation, that you are talking to somebody that is going to be able to make a decision. They're going to be the ones that are going to be talking to you folks and us directly, and working to improve a situation that might need a decision on. It's don't have to go through a chain of command like it did it at the Department of Aviation, but the director can make a decision immediately. I think that more time for the staff is available to work on problems and solutions at the Department of Aviation, because they don't have to deal with the bureaucracy that was in the Department of Transportation. When you get a big bureaucracy and a little part of it, I always think of a little boy pulling on his dad's pants and saying, "Daddy, I would like to go do this," and he says, "Well, I'm too busy. I can't do that right now." And you know, it once you separate those two people, even a staff of 19 at the Department of Aviation is just a little drop in the bucket at a big bureaucracy of 4,500. And we believe that Ann is doing a tremendous job over there in the department, and we've only had a year or so to really get the board on track and decide what the Department of Aviation is going to be. But I think that there's a good opportunity to reach out to a lot of different organizations for additional money that was not appropriate to do when they was in the Department of Transportation. Governor Budget has a line item for $12 million in the budget this year, and I understand that's the first time that we've ever had a line item for a budget for aviation in the budget. That's mainly what I have. There's probably some other things that will come up in some questions. I hope you have some questions that you could ask me, and I'll turn it over to Bob.
Mr. Taylor, did you have a presentation?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the Transportation Committee, and good morning. My name is Buck Taylor, and I'm the airport manager for the Corvallis Municipal Airport, Corvallis, Oregon. And I'm here today representing the Oregon Airport Management Association, or referred to as OAMA. And we appreciate the opportunity to come before you this morning to share our thoughts and our ideas on aviation and the airport system here in Oregon. OAMA was formed in 1959 with the purpose of bringing together all persons representing public use airports, as well as the persons interested in working in general benefit of aviation. Since its inception, OAMA faithfully strives to accomplish the following goals and objectives. 1, to study and take action of all matters involving the welfare of the citizens of the state of Oregon, which are of concern to or the responsibility of airport management and or those in the field of aviation. To place the public safety and welfare above all other interests and to apply the special knowledge and skills of airport and aviation personnel to benefit all persons. To promote the recognition and the importance of airport management's responsibilities and the value and the benefits of adequate aviation facilities throughout the state. To help municipalities to evaluate, establish, monitor, and improve their aviation efforts. To encourage the employment of highly qualified and equitably compensated airport and aviation personnel. To develop, recommend, and promote uniform regulation and legislation pertaining to airport and aviation facilities. To review and research all proposed aviation legislation, process amendments when deemed appropriate, and to make each of our OLAMA members aware of the implications of such legislation. To operate with and promote the purposes and objectives of other aviation-oriented activities and professionals, and to advance the professional skills of those involved in administration and development of aviation field. OLAMA has been able to and continues to accomplish these goals and objectives with membership of more than 100 professional men and women throughout the state of Oregon who have a strong interest and dedication to manage and maintain the 101 public use airports in our state. Together with the support and the partnership of the Oregon Department of Aviation, we pursue our efforts in continuing to build and maintain a modern and efficient and usable airport system in Oregon. OLAMA applauds the 1999 legislature in taking the bold step in allowing the Department of Aviation to separate and again create an independent department within the state of Oregon. This action has allowed the Aviation Department to simplify and streamline the bureaucratic layers between the Aviation Department and the citizens, which are the airport users, and to create a direct link of the Aviation Department and to our legislators. This was accomplished with a direct savings of dedicated aviation user fees while reducing the overhead and operating of the department. The Department of Aviation has already taken strides forward this first year in implementing a fantastic and sorely needed airport pavement maintenance program. This program, using aviation fuel tax monies, is benefiting all airports in Oregon. Many of the small rural airports that have very little financial support will now be able to maintain and preserve their runway infrastructures. This benefits all of Oregon in being able to maintain the very vital structure network that has been established in the state. With the U.S. Congress passage of Air 21 bill, for the first time in many years, airports will possibly see additional funds made available for updating maintenance deferred or obsolete infrastructures that are badly needed throughout our state. Newport may have the opportunity to have an ILS lighting system installed to allow pilots to make a safer instrument approach during the foggy coastal days. Hillsboro will be able to relocate a major street to increase the parameters of their runway safety area. And Corvallis will be able to replace worn-out lighted runways signs, affording pilots the safe movement and directions on the airport at night. These are just a few of the projects that are a direct result of this. Air 21 will also provide additional funds to the Department of Aviation, allowing more projects throughout the state to be considered. This is all very good news, and OLAMA is excited about the prospects of the next few years. However, more can and needs to be done on the state level toward the Oregon State Airports and Transportation System as we come into this new millennium. Some topics that are being discussed around the state include the simplification of the card lock system of self-fueling of aircraft, support of subsidized commuter air service to the communities that once had service prior to the airline deregulation of 1978, and the economic support and research, the economic support for research and development of more than 32 aircraft and aviation support manufacturers in the state of Oregon. While no one really wants to pick up a political football at this time, until Oregon revises or modifies its legislation on self-service fueling and joins the other 49 states that do allow self-service fueling at airports, the aviation community will continue to be economically handicapped, especially in the rural airports, particularly in eastern Oregon. OAMA and the Oregon Pilots Association have recently met with the State Fire Marshal's Office and the Department of Aviation to discuss some possible solutions to simplify the existing regulations to make the card lock system viable for a local or transit pilot who's needing aviation fuel. The other topics seem to have no quick or simple answers. However, individuals, corporations, and communities continue to research and seek solutions to improve the convenience, availability, and the affordable use of air travel throughout the state of Oregon. With the continued help and support of this great legislature, together we can make Oregon aviation and transportation a vital link to the rest of the world. Respectfully.
Mr. Taylor, thank you. Thank you very much. I'd like to note that we are looking forward to hearing from Ann Krupp, who is the Director of Aviation, and she'll be testifying before the committee in the next couple of weeks, so we'll have another opportunity to address questions. Do we have any questions?
Yes, sir.
Yes, Representative Brown?
Do you know the $12 million for the Department of Aviation's budget, is any of that from the general fund, or is that all from user fees?
It's my understanding, Buck, if you don't mind, that they're 100% funded by fuel tax, user fees, aircraft and pilot registrations.
Just a comment. I'm from Newport, and we did get that $3 million grant to install the approach lighting system there.
That is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course, aviation is very close to my heart, and having spent a number of years in this industry, could you tell me what is the fuel tax, aviation fuel tax? I mean, what do we pay?
Right, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, 6 cents on the dollar.
And does that 6 cents now follow?
That has been recently increased.
May I ask when that was?
It was a two-step process, and it was over the last year, I believe. I know when we go to the pump, it's higher.
Mr. Chair, would it be possible to ask you, Mr. Taylor, and Mr.
Ballet.
If we could please have a written testimony, it really helps us who you know, need to go back and refer to our notes, and I would be really grateful.
Yes.
Okay. Other questions? Chair, I'd like to ask you about the bill that I think we passed on the floor last time for self-fueling at airports.
Yes, sir.
Did that survive? Was it signed, and did it not go far enough? Could you please address where that piece of legislation
went to? Yes, sir. It was signed, and probably to make a simple analogy, pilot that leaves an airport here in Oregon flies to Washington or any of the surrounding states, basically pulls up to a dispensing fuel system, secures the aircraft, connects it with a static wire, simply takes a MasterCard, Visa card, swipes a machine, a questionnaire comes up, and they go through a process of answering some brief questions on safety that's basically required by the state fire marshals of that state. They're accepted, and the pump is turned on, and the pilot fuels this aircraft. In the state of Oregon, the way the system works is that if the airport operator as a self-service system, the pilot must be a member of that organization prior to any fueling, and he or she must take a written test submitted to the fire marshal and to also a $5 fee that goes to the vendor through to the fire marshal. If that pilot then goes, and let's say that this is at Corvallis, and then this pilot goes to Redmond, and they have a self-service, they have to do the same thing all over again. And it's just not a viable situation, even for our resident pilots, let alone a transient pilot coming from out of the state. And we're losing a lot of revenue at these self-service systems. It just doesn't make it viable.
So you're introducing a bill to address this?
We're working with the fire marshal to simplify this existing regulations at this time.
Mr. Chair, if I may, it is we're working within the bill that was passed last year.
Right.
We're not trying to push any particular legislation to change that. We believe that we can deal within those parameters and abide by the law and what the state fire marshal is requiring within the law that was passed last session.
Mr. Taylor, Mr. DeLay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we would ask to testify Craig Campbell with AAA of Oregon.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Craig Campbell, and I'm here representing AAA Oregon, Idaho. I'm sure most of you have heard a little bit of the background of AAA before, but just to get it on the record again, we represent about 600,000 members statewide. We represent them doing roadside service. We do travel planning for them, and we also provide governmental relations assistance here at the Capitol. I know you're under a fairly tight time frame, so I'm going to be fairly brief with what AAA's issues are going to be during this session. The first and foremost, of course, is going to be the question about the gas tax, whether or not a gas tax is a possibility during this session. We've been engaging ourselves in conversations with the governor, with the majority and minority offices, the chairs of both House and Senate Transportation Committees, and if you have not seen me in your office yet, you will soon. Basically, we're trying to gauge whether or not a 2-cent gas tax is possible. Now, as you know, AAA has traditionally been supportive of a gas tax increase until after the bill last session left the House and went over to the Senate. That then conflicted with another issue that I'll talk to you about very briefly in a moment. But essentially, at that point in time, AAA was in opposition to what became ballot measure 82 and then worked for its defeat. But in doing so, we promised that we would, after that process, find out what the public would accept if they would not accept what came out with ballot measure 82. And as a result, 2 days after the end of that election, we went to a poll of 500 people statewide through Bob Moore's organization and got an indication of what would be acceptable to the people of Oregon. Start out with an indication that those asked whether they supported or opposed ballot measure 82 were very close to what the election came out with. It was about 88-12, 88% opposed to ballot measure 82 and 12% in support. But those same folks answered that 64% agreed that they would be willing to support funding for our roads and highways, provided that it was deemed fair. So we decided we would get a little more specific and asked about would they support a 4-cent, a 3-cent, and a 2-cent. And ultimately, what it came down to is the only request that came above 50% was the 2-cent gas tax. We also asked them about some other alternative funding, specifically things like a registration fee increase. They were actually also supportive of that idea, but when you match a 2-cent gas tax with a $10 per year registration fee increase, then you drop back below 50%. And so AAA basically determined from that the only viable alternative during this legislative session to deal with highway funding is 2 cents. Granted, AAA understands that barely keeps up with the inflation loss that will occur over the next 10 years or 2 years. It can't be looked at as any sort of a long-term solution. And in fact, that's another thing that I wish to talk to you a little bit about today, and that is the long-term viability of the gas tax. We know that with new hybrid vehicles, new forms of fuel for vehicles that are not currently taxed, that over time, whether that be 10 years from now or 20 years from now, the gas tax is no longer going to be a viable way of taxing cars. Unfortunately, when you ask the public what would they like to replace gas taxes with, they range very broadly from, I really hate that idea, to over my dead body. So, and the polling seems to support that viewpoint. Nevertheless, AAA is interested in assisting this committee and those that are interested in transportation at looking at the first stages of what sort of things are out there. I think one thing that would go a long way to easing the public's mind is if any alternative was thoroughly studied and found out whether or not, in fact, it worked before it was implemented, rather than waiting until we were really up against the wall and then implementing whatever was the most popular idea at the time. Not that that would ever happen, but when you deal with urgency of highway funding, tensions and needs can get rather high. We do realize that there is a problem with Oregon's highway system, and it's not always visible. The way roads deteriorate, sometimes you can see the deterioration on the surface of the roads, and sometimes that can be dealt with in a relatively inexpensive way. Unfortunately, the longer you wait to repair roads, the deterioration subsurface, the structural integrity of the roads start to deteriorate, and you can't visibly see that deterioration. The longer you wait to repair it, the more expensive it becomes. So the longer we wait to do something about the maintenance and preservations of a road, the more expensive it will become. And because of that, AAA is going to be introducing a very simple 2-cent gas tax bill. We have no idea whether or not it's going to have any wings, but we're going to give it a shot. And if it doesn't, we'll come and we'll let you know that. But if it looks like there's a possibility, AAA will be here asking for your vote to support that bill. It will be very simple. It will merely have a 2-cent gas tax increase and an equivalent increase in weight mile taxes. It will not have a provision for bonding in it. I know bonding is popular because it provides a list of programs that the people can look to see what they're getting for their tax dollars. Unfortunately, it also creates a lot of political problems about who gets what programs and whether or not you're adding or subtracting votes from the proposal as a whole. In addition to that, as we were just talking a moment ago about the long-term viability of a gas tax, if you bond against that over time, your ability to maintain the funding for that that bonding goes down, and that's a real concern. So as a result, the bill will not have a provision in it for bonding. At that point, I think I'm going to leave briefly the gas tax. I'll talk briefly about the weight mile tax, of course, which is still one of AAA's major issues. We want to make sure that the weight mile tax is maintained. However, we're also interested in making that tax easier to comply with and more efficient. And so we'll be working with those. There will be a bill that will be coming through that deals with the efficiencies of the weight mile tax, and we fully plan on engaging in that. In addition, there is a lawsuit, of course, that deals primarily with the farm plate exemption and the flat fee. AAA has filed to become an intervener in that lawsuit. I don't anticipate that that issue is going to come up during the session as a result of the lawsuit, but did want to let you know that AAA plans on being engaged in that process as well. There are a variety of other issues that I'd like to come back and talk to you as we go through and as they come up, but since I know that you're under a time crunch, I figured I would present that. And if you have any questions for me, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have any questions from the committee? Yes.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Campbell, could you please put your testimony in writing so that we could have text of it for the future?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, absolutely.
Thank you so much. What is your role as an intervener?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, AAA will be presenting its own case based on its own interpretations of the facts. In other words, we will be a completely separate party and acting on our own initiative.
And not on behalf of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, on behalf of AAA's members, yes, but not on behalf of the state, although we will probably be very closely aligned to the state's arguments.
Yes, Representative.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Campbell. In your discussions with the polling of the gas tax and with others, Have you looked at other options other than registration and gas tax for long-term funding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, in fact, we asked a whole series of different options, ranging from tolls on new highways and bridges, congestion pricing, gas tax increase tied to inflation, annual mileage fees, household business access fees, the gamut. And what we found is that none of them were at all popular. And that was, I wouldn't say altogether surprising. The level of lack of support surprised us in a couple of instances, but generally the public is not very accepting of alternative funding sources at this time. One area where they were supportive was the area of privatization of road and highway projects, but of course Oregon already does a rather substantial amount of private construction work on our highways. I would imagine that would probably reflect going into design and engineering and things like that.
A follow-up. Your polling showed that people are supportive of helping us improve the highway system. Do you think it's a matter that they don't want to pay for it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that's a tough question because there's always going to be those who really don't want to have an increase in taxes. And there are going to be those who don't want to pay that particular tax, or they don't trust that the people who enact the tax really did the right thing. I mean, there's so many different reasons, and I can't tell you that the poll reflected one way or the other how they felt about that. So I wish I could be more help, but I can't.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Devlin?
Yes. One of the things that we've done in Washington County and actually done also in Western Clackamas County is something that many of my colleagues say is not feasible in other areas of the state. And that is we've funded a lot of transportation projects with general obligation bonds, property tax based. And in all of those cases, we've offered the public specific projects and specific timelines on when those projects would be completed. But what's interesting to me, and I don't know if you'd comment, is that the public might have a resistance to even a 2 cent gas tax increase, which for someone that drives a little bit more than the state average, 15,000 miles and has about 20 miles per gallon, you know, average of fuel consumption, is about $15 a year. Some of the major streets transportation improvement programs in Washington County, which have been funded in those cases with serial levies, have been equivalent to probably 80 cents per thousand, which on a $200,000 home, which is like much of my district in Washington County, is about $160 a year. Now, how do we explain that the public has a resistance to paying $15 a year for gas taxes additional, but will buy into $160 in additional property taxes for specific projects?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, understand this would be purely speculative on from my point, but when you have a list of many projects that you can vote on for a statewide thing, the level of trust may be far less than if you have a single project in your neighborhood that you have language in front of you that when you're voting, you can say, by gosh, that's what the money's going to. I think it's a much easier sell to do that because they see the immediate need and the immediate result. Once you separate from that directness, the level of trust of the public and what happens deteriorates. It's awfully hard to convince folks that even if it's on paper, that's actually what's going to happen. I don't know why that's the case, but that tends to be the case.
Other follow-up?
Did your polling generally show still what we've seen in other polling, still problems with the public's perception of ODOT in terms of its efficiency and in terms of how it's managing tax dollars?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, actually just the opposite. The public polling actually showed that the people were fairly trusting of ODOT. Right around a little bit above 60%, I think it was 64% trusted ODOT.
So that is it they don't trust us or they don't trust ODOT?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I would not have offered this information had it not been asked. Granted, this is dealing specifically with transportation issues, but it is true that the legislatures, the trust of the people in the legislature to make transportation decisions is not terribly high. The number one group that has trust, the trust of the people is actually Oregon State Police when it came to transportation issues. Fortunately, AAA was number two, so we were really pleased by that. But honestly, I think it will probably be dependent upon the type of proposal that comes out as to the level of trust. Understand that, ballot measure 82 tried to do an awful lot, so it was a big document with a lot of stuff in it. So that's it's a difficult thing to get a trust based on that.
There are some questions, Representative Devlin, that we don't necessarily want to ask.
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Campbell, is it possible that you'd share your poll with us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we can share some of the poll. The poll was also designed as a marketing test, so there was a lot of other questions that, quite frankly, you probably wouldn't be all that interested in. But we can get a summary of the findings for you and provide that to you if that would be helpful to you.
I'd like to ask you about a recent ODOT study that found damage to the roads by studded tires in the range of about $60 million a year. There is a discussion underway about regulating or banning studded tires. Does AAA plan to get involved in this particular issue?
Mr. Chair, yes, we'll be involved in it. My understanding is that there's a couple of proposals that are dealing with a fee for usage sort of idea. In the past, AAA was concerned about the idea of banning specifically studded tires. One, because there are some folks that depend on them, and two, there weren't any alternatives at that point in time. Now there are some alternative tires that are available that are very effective. So, yeah, we'll be very involved in that discussion and hope to be supportive of whatever comes out.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We have two more individuals who plan to testify, and the first is Jacqueline Zimmer of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jacqueline Zimmer, and I am the State Association Director of the Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, and we're also referred to as O4AD, and we're also called the AAAs. So we're a mentor, so as you will know, we're not connected with the previous speaker and his association. So you'll catch that if you hear that again. Interestingly enough, we were disappointed that the gas tax failed and failed so wildly last year, because there was some funding in there for senior and disabled transportation, and it would have provided a stable funding source for our growing program around the state. So that was unfortunate for us. And in this year's budget, there's $1 million reduction posted for senior and disabled transportation. So we often match all of the dollars that the state gives us, and so for us it's a little bigger hit than that. It could go as high as $3 million in total funds, just the $1 million that we are losing. Not to really whine to you, we were certainly grateful for the money that we did receive last session. That was the first new money we had received in senior disabled transportation for I think about 15 years. So the additional $9 million we got last session, plus $10 million so that we could do some capital purchases, was very welcome and put to good use. And I want to talk a little bit about that to you this morning. And before I go on, I just want to mention that we did identify the need in senior and disabled transportation to be about $50 million per biennium. So we're not quite there. Nor does it look like we'll get there, I think, considering the current service level issues that we have. I want you also to know some of you I have not met with yet, and I want you to understand that there are 18 area agencies on aging around the state in Oregon. Some are very small and do transportation and meal site work, information and referral. Some are quite large, as Multnomah County, and they do aging and disabilities. Some do aging and disabilities and veterans, so we're kind of a mixed bunch. But all of us are involved in transportation in some form or another. So if you want, at some point I'll go through that system with you so that you can have a better understanding of it. It's mixed up, but it works. So we're providing services to about 70% of the state's seniors and people with disabilities. And by disabilities, I mean folks that are 18 to 65. Not necessarily developmentally disabled, although that population is aging, and soon they will be, our clients. That'll be interesting to have them come into the system as seniors. But since most of those individuals prefer to live at home, transportation that's really accessible and that's safe and reliable and doesn't leave people stranded at a medical appointment or something during the day is really important to us. We participate in the special transportation fund allocation process. We're working in the metropolitan area on a brokerage issue up there. We're also serving on just about any time there's a statewide committee on transportation planning. We serve on it. The ODOT Public Transit Division Advisory Committee, the Older Driver Study Advisory Committee. You'll see some legislation on maybe some changes to the way older drivers get their licenses this year. Or proposed anyway, and the Governor State Transportation Coordination Advisory Committee, which is a committee that's been designed to help integrate transportation options around the state to see if we can make better use of perhaps buses that are and vans and vehicles that are not being used at all times. Perhaps we can take advantage of those to provide transit around the state. In urban areas of the state, we authorize thousands of rides a day for seniors and persons with disabilities, and we try to do that and assure quality and safe services to clients. In the Tri-County area, we co-sponsored the first long-range elderly and disabled transportation planning project with TriMet, Metro, ODOT, and other agencies. So that group comes together as a result of new transportation fund dollars, and the goal is to have a comprehensive inventory of the resources in the area and the identification of service gaps and plans to fill those needs. What it does is it formally recognizes the demographic impact and the challenge of supporting independence in an urban area. And as you know, in about 4 years, there should be about 250,000 people in Oregon who are over the age of 85, and many of them will actually live independently in the community. So transit, door-through-door transit is a critical component there, and the metropolitan area is looking at that very hard. I wanted to talk just briefly about some of the things that we've done with the money that we were given during the interim. And once we recovered from the shock of actually getting new money and it began to filter down to our systems, we tried to very quickly start putting new services in place. That was delayed a little bit by things like actually having money to buy a vehicle. We ordered the vehicles and you had to wait for them to come before we could start providing the services. So there's been a bit of a lag, but I see things really hitting their stride. In Marion and Polk County, for example, they've been able to add 2,500 monthly trips. They've expanded their Woodburn volunteer system, and that brings to mind that a significant number of our transportation programs operate using volunteers, which makes the dollars go a lot further. Silverton has something called a silver trolley that used to operate 3 days a week. Now it operates five. And up in the Santa Ana Canyon, there are about 8,000 more rides per year. Traveling up and down that canyon. In Polk County, they added 800 trips a month, and they've added dial-a-ride service that picks up some overflow on a couple of routes. There's bus buddy transportation programs around the state now where someone comes and helps seniors and the disabled actually learn how to navigate the system. I'm actually going to use someone like that in Portland here pretty soon. And in Linn County, the Interfaith Caregivers will have a new wheelchair van that'll provide medical rides out of town for people in wheelchairs. The Linn Shuttle provides rides throughout Linn County and then added new rides to Brownville and Halsey. Benton County has dial-a-bus throughout the county, and they also have evening and weekend hours, which is great. Seniors have a very difficult time generally driving at night. In Lincoln County, there's door-to-door service throughout the county. That's very important to us, that actually people be able to maybe step in and help you get your coat on and help you get out the door. Kind of a sweet note that we found when we did a study about people needing transportation service. Many seniors said that they would take the bus if they could get to the bus shelter. And many said, if we said, well, if a bus shelter was within two blocks of your house, would you ride the bus? And they said, yes, but could you please put some benches in along the way so that I can rest? I mean, they honestly thought they would go ahead and get to the bus stop if we could help them get there. So door-to-door service is really important, getting the groceries in the house, maybe helping put some of them away, that sort of thing. Clackamas County provided 68,000 rides last year, and then in just an immediate past, they've added another 8,000 a year. They've had some new vans, driver safety kits, transportation coordinators. These things are sort of being done all over the state. This morning I have some folks here from Columbia County who are adamant activists on this issue and have a model program. They have provided 40,000 rides last year to seniors and people with disabilities. They brought up an interesting point, and that is, in that area, as in many areas of the state, the medical providers are pulling out. The HMOs are pulling out of the area. Clinics are closing, and so transit becomes significant to them because people have to be taken to Portland and other areas in order to get simple medical services. So that's another reason that we need to enhance transportation services around the state. Another point is that a significant number of our drivers are, as you probably know, probably paid minimum wage. And so you sort of got to love this job if you're going to work in our area. So that's another thing to consider when you're talking about sending transportation dollars out to the community. That they're going to people who are probably being paid minimum wage to do the job. So just wanted to make you aware of some of those. I think you're going to vote on an ODOT budget at some point this year, and I just wanted you to keep in mind that we're a little short there, and that we will continue to work to keep people in their homes or in community-based living situations, and that saves the state money, and it saves taxpayers money, but we have to do a little investing as well. Any questions?
Any of your citizen advocates like to ask?
That's so nice of you to offer. They did decline. They recognize the committee is busy, but they've asked to come back at another time.
It's very good to have you here this morning. Thank you for coming. Representative Devlin.
Thank you. Part of the appropriation last time, of course, I believe went to replacing vehicles in many cases. Was there any attempt in coordination of those purchases in terms of, were we able to get any better prices by different groups going out together or going through maybe a state contract or something, or were they all purchasing individually from, you know, the different groups that are providing transportation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I don't have the most comprehensive answer that I'd like to have for you. There was some of that going on in some areas, but I can't. There are some areas that come to mind, but I'm not certain of the concerted effort that was out there to do that.
I'd be interested, you know, if you had some information on that, because I know in many cases they'd want to actually purchase vehicles with lifts also.
Right. I will, Mr. Chair, Representative, I will get a better answer for you on that. I know there was some, but I think the Dalles did that and a couple of other areas did that. So.
Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many partnerships do you have throughout the state with hospitals? Hospital who would provide the vehicle, pay for maintenance and gas for seniors to be brought to the hospital or clinics?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, there are a number of assorted contracts that we take advantage of and pursue throughout the state. I would have to check on how many hospitals we actually make contract with. We're very creative in doing things like sharing a facility vehicle with maybe an assisted living facility, some churches. We've done without for so many years and sort of scrapped along and cobbled the system together that there's a tremendous amount of resource sharing going on, but I would have to certainly seek that answer for you, and I'd be willing to do that if you'd just give me a little time.
Just a follow-up comment, and I just think the public is always glad to know that there are other ways rather than just tax dollars going in, and I think your creativity is a wonderful thing that needs to be made known publicly, because I know how hard some of these agencies work to create other people helping. So I would really encourage you to let the public know that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Verde. The Columbia County people, for example, actually provide 80,000 rides a year in their system, and 40,000 of those are seniors and people with disabilities. So you can, we're blending as best we can. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Zimmer, I wish you also had statistics of what our transportation board has done out of Yamhill County, because you would likewise be very, very proud of our team there and what the group has done together with, you know, the other agencies and Mid Valley Workshop. Those really needing these services, along with our commissioners and staff. Can you tell me if are we privileged to your budget? You've asked for a considerable sum of money, and I wonder if this is something that you share with us.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the transportation budget for seniors and persons with disabilities.
Wait, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Ms. Zimmer, I believe you said you needed $50 million per biennium.
Right.
And do you have that breakdown? I mean, would we be able to understand this?
I think yes, Mr. Chair, is enough, and I believe that you could. It's a study that we used last session as our talking piece, so I'd be happy to share that with the committee.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Thank you so much for testifying today. And our final presenter is Scott Canton-Wine of Cascade Warehouse.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Committee. My name is Scott Canton-Wine. I'm the president of Cascade Warehouse Company. We have truck rail transfer facilities in Salem, Oregon, and Junction City, Oregon. First of all, it's nice to be able to come before the committee with nothing really at stake yet. And unlike some of the prior testimonies, my particular testimony is more or less based on the fact that over the course of the years as a private business person and an interested citizen, that I represent no group other than my company and myself. I've been actively involved in city issues, county issues, and state issues regarding transportation, and specifically the mobility of freight. So just as you're sometimes it's nice to have the last word, especially the last word when there's still people around to hear it. So I think what I want to do today is just send you away with a couple of bullet points, talking points that provide you some food for thought as you do your legislative duties and as this session unfolds. First of all, I think one of the most important facts that you need to remember is that your blueprint, whatever you put together, whatever you create, needs to be something basic. I mean, we have to cover the basics. And I think over the years, the Department of Transportation is just that. It's not the Department of Highway Expansion. It's not the Department of Bridge Building. It is the Department of Transportation. And within the context of that department, we need to talk about the highways, the waterways, the airways, and the railways. The varying needs a lot of times are interwoven, and I think from a financial efficiency standpoint, that the more we can weave the various modes of transportation, we all know that we need to get more for our dollar and we need to get more from the infrastructure. And each one of those various modes, periodically, time to time, session to session, certainly have more impact. Our highways are more congested. The waterways, with the current issues revolving around the salmon and even now electricity, are in a unique unique position. The airways, we heard the airports and the Port of Portland talking about time sensitivity, and the railways, from a planning standpoint and from an existing infrastructure standpoint, are certainly underused, both from a freight movement standpoint and a people movement standpoint. And we need to keep those into perspective as we throw dollars around. And we heard a little bit of conversation about pricing and about polling and about dollars and cents and spending, but I certainly want to remind you that The prices that were thrown around last time regarding an increase, I know Representative Devlin had a good point there in dollar-to-dollar spending, but the increase in gas tax on the commercial side of business paled in comparison to the double-digit fuel price increases that those businesses, for the most part, were able to absorb. So, I think in kind of summarizing and bringing things to a close, there's a price to pay to maintaining and improving some of the world's finest infrastructure. We need to make the case, and we need to sell it. We cannot get caught up in special interest blitzes. You represent the people, and they far outnumber cumulatively any individual lobbying effort. For this committee to be successful, we need to override some of those commercial obstacles for the social good. And myself personally and the business I represent, I'm a freight and transportation evangelist, and I'm going to do my best to put out the word that if we want to create a good society that moves our people where they need to be, our goods where they need to go, then we're going to have to pay for it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Well, if there are no questions, the committee will reconvene at 9 a.m. on Wednesday. Thank you, everyone, for coming. We're adjourned.
Thank you. Yes, I do, and I know he probably we should white
Well, I need to just call
I'd like to always.